Alan Grayson speaking.
Congressman Grayson and senatorial candidate Grayson, this is Richard Spisak of Progressive News Network, sir. I want to thank you for coming to the show. We're so happy to have you. We've supported you and your fine efforts for a long time. And let me go right into it, sir. Did you just attend Netroots, I understand?
Yes, I did.
Why don't you give us your impression of it, sir?
It's Woodstock for liberals. It's a place where kindred spirits can get together and share ideas and enjoy themselves.
Well, it's not all just fun and games. There's some very important topics raised. I understand that racial justice was a very important topic that was discussed at the conference.
Absolutely. That problem is in our faces. It's growing. And when anybody is treated unequally, then everybody is treated unequally. There can never be any exceptions. An attack on any part of us is an attack on all of us.
Let me ask you another question. I understand that the discussion also covered the state of abortion access and reproductive justice. While the right has been unable to overturn the Supreme Court's decision, they have nibbled away and cut away and cut away until more and more American women find themselves absolutely unavailable to use what is their constitutional right.
Well, I see some hope in the recent Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court decided a week ago that it would not allow anything resembling an undue burden on the right to choice, the right to terminate a pregnancy. And if the Supreme Court follows through on that, then they'll strike down all of these state laws that have popped up all around the country, particularly in the South, where state legislators, right-wingers, Republicans, make an effort to create so many practical barriers to exercising the right to choice that it basically negates the right itself.
Those of us who've been involved in the battle, the ongoing struggle to improve human rights, not just here but across the globe, we're very concerned, many of us are very concerned about the Black Lives Matter movement and how we can somehow find a way to reconcile the serious concerns of both the African-American community, the community of color, and police officers as well. I was wondering, do you think that there's some kind of reconciliation might be undertaken to bring these two, you know, difficult issues to resolve?
I don't think there's any kind of tension involved there at all.
Okay.
No one has to be reminded that the lives of police officers matter. We all understand that. Nobody's suggesting otherwise. The reason why the Black Lives Matter movement exists is not because white lives don't matter, but because no one needs to be reminded that white lives matter. Whereas there's very much a need to remind people of Black Lives Mattering. There's a deep ingrained inequality in society that's reflected sometimes in police violence, but more typically in just grinding everyday inequality and poverty. You know, we have, as I'm talking to you, I'm sitting in Tampa right now. There was a case of a 14-year-old boy who was picked up for no good reason by the police, taken 2 miles after he was arrested, pushed out of the car because they couldn't even think of any charges to bring against him. And when he tried to get back to where his parents were going to pick him up, he got run over on I-4. It's a 14-year-old boy who's gone now. I've tried to get an investigation of racial profiling by the Tampa police, but that's the tip of the iceberg. When you look into it, you recognize that there's enormous inequality in everyday life. Some of the examples I normally give is that 29% of all whites go to college, 18% of all African Americans go to college. The average white household makes $57,000 a year. The average black household makes $37,000 a year. The average white man lives till the age of 79, and the average black man lives to the age of 74. So I ask people the very pointed question, what's really more tragic, that one 14-year-old lost a half century of his life, or that 40 million lose 5 years apiece? We don't make any progress by depicting Black Lives Matter as somehow pitted against some contrary force. The only contrary force in existence is the inequality, the discrimination, the bigotry that African Americans face every day that Black Lives Matter is trying to highlight and call to attention as the new civil rights movement.
Absolutely. And in fact, you've been very involved in the economic struggle represented by the corporate giveaway that's called TPP.
Yes, you know, for those of your listeners who aren't familiar with it, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is referred to as TPP, is an enormous giveaway to multinational corporations. It's being perpetrated by the trade representative and the White House, and in league with the Chamber of Commerce and the Republican Party. It's one of those areas where the White House finds itself completely on the wrong side of the issue as compared to almost every Democrat in Congress. And the reason for that is very simple. It's an enormous corporate welfare giveaway. And it takes us even further down the road to national bankruptcy. Right now, as you sit here, as I sit here, our trade deficit is $1 billion a day. That's not just a number. That means that we're spending $1 billion on employing foreign workers, but foreigners are not spending the same $1 billion employing American workers. So over the course of the whole year, what happens is we put to work tens of millions of foreign workers, and we borrow money from foreigners to do that. They don't reciprocate. That's what the trade deficit is, the difference between what we spend and what foreigners spend to put us to work. They don't reciprocate. So the result is that not only do we lose the jobs, but we drive ourselves deeper and deeper and deeper into debt for the benefit of multinational corporations. The only entities that benefit from that arrangement are multinational corporations. In other words, foreign workers don't benefit. American workers don't benefit. And this was shown very vividly with NAFTA. NAFTA did something that economists thought was impossible. It managed to impoverish both American workers and Mexican workers strictly for the benefit of multinational corporations. And that's become the paradigm ever since. You know, before NAFTA went into effect, this country never had a trade deficit of $135 billion in any given year. Every single year for 20 years in a row, America's had a trade deficit of more than $135 billion. In fact, our last 14 trade deficits are the largest trade deficits, not only in the history of America, but in the history of the entire world. So we are being driven down a slippery slope into national bankruptcy and debt slavery for the benefit of multinational corporations. The TPP accelerates those processes, it greases the skids.
One of the other concerns about the TPP is that it also, in addition to basically outsourcing so much of our economy, also hands the negotiations, hands reconciliation or judgment issues to the corporations to resolve and takes them out of public court and public hands.
That's right. You know, for 200 years now, if anyone, American, foreigner, foreign corporation, anyone, claimed that the government was being unfair to it and wanted to assert a claim against it, then what they would do is they would sue in federal court. In fact, there's a court right across the street from the White House called the Court of Federal Claims that's open to anybody who has a claim like that, that the government's deprived you of your life, your liberty, or your property. That's what it's been there for now for all of that time. The TPP sets up an alternative process that's open only to foreign corporations, not to American citizens, not to American corporations, not to foreign individuals, but only to foreign corporations, that allows them to sue outside of our courts in before the World Bank or the United Nations in what they call arbitration tribunals that are completely rigged. To give you an example of how rigged the system is, the so-called judges at these arbitration tribunals can actually be working for one of the parties in a different case. So that kind of gross conflict of interest is permitted, and it basically undermines the entire process. But what it does is it lets the United Nations or the World Bank issue money judgments, awards on behalf of these foreign corporations against not only the federal government, but also state governments and also local municipal governments, county governments and municipal governments. And the net result of that is that a foreign corporation that gets angry at a town or a city can drive them into bankruptcy just through litigation alone. Because they claim that they're denying them their God-given right to make a profit. So just to give you one example, the nation of Canada is now before one of these courts because they decided that they wanted to keep their own water, and a company wants to take the water from Canada and ship it out and sell it. So when the Canadians said no, they wouldn't allow that, they sued them. another company brought a case against a country for refusing to allow candy cigarettes to be sold. In other words, cigarettes that are specifically targeted toward minors. I'm not talking about cigarettes made out of candy. I'm talking about cigarettes that have candy in them for flavoring. And that, you know, that company sued that country. Now that matters before the World Bank. So what it is, and I explain this very thoroughly in my website, tradetreachery.com. What this is an enormous giveaway to multinational corporations that would have tragic effects on the American middle class. Basically, marks the end of the middle class in America.
I do want to have you talk about the national issues, some national issues as well. But before we get to that, I want to focus on your candidacy for the Senate. Number one, the Republican opponent is a gentleman who really was too busy, and he felt that to him the Senate wasn't important enough for him to waste his time there. I'm referring, of course, to Marco Rubio. But another thing that troubles a lot of Democrats, not just progressives, but moderates alike, that somehow it seems that the National Party has got their thumb on the scales and is actually spending money against Democrats, people like yourself.
It's ridiculous. It's utterly ridiculous. You know, people got upset because the debate schedule seemed to be rigged in favor of one presidential candidate and against another. This is way beyond that. All those $10 and $15 and $50 contributions that people make to the National Democratic Party are now being wasted to defeat me because I'm a progressive candidate. They have a right-winger who is so right-wing that he personally gave $2,300 to Mitt Romney's campaign. And he was a Republican almost up until the moment that he decided to run for office as a Democrat. And they're favoring him over me, a lifelong Democrat who voted blue, even though I was elected from a district where they're the Republican for 34 years in a row when I was first elected to Congress. They're favoring him over me, spending party money to try to drag his rear end across the line against me because he's a Wall Street candidate and I'm not.
You know, one would like to think that the Democratic Party gives room for progressive ideas, gives room for a spectrum of Democratic opinion, and certainly doesn't tilt the board in one favor. We've seen national leaders come down and stump the state for this gentleman, and he's such a fresh Democrat. He's actually made statements that he thought that partisanship was a bad idea.
Oh, it's far worse than that. I mean, according to the National Journal, he had the fifth worst voting record of any Democrat in the House. There's 187 of us. He was the only Democrat who voted to kill high-speed rail in Florida, even though it runs through his own district, because he was angry that his father wasn't able to get the construction contract for it. He voted seven times to force the president to license the Keystone Pipeline, even though the president decided against that. He voted over and over and over again to reverse Obamacare and reverse the Dodd-Frank financial Wall Street reforms. He voted even to create the Benghazi committee, the Benghazi witch hunt committee, that only four current Democrats in the House had the temerity to vote for in allegiance with the Republicans. He was one of those four Democrats. This is a man who has cut the lawn to little pieces and sold it to the highest bidder time and time again. It was actually endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce. And despite that, the National Democratic Party, which has become hopelessly corrupt under Harry Reid, who has been nothing but a bagman his entire career for corporate interests, the National Democratic Party is spending the money of our contributors, our blue money. They're wasting it trying to defeat me and instead favor this Republican masquerading as a Democrat.
Well, you know, I mean, I could go on and list the wonderful things you've done, but I just want to point to a couple of them. You've assisted increasing the funding for medical research. Now, we see the anti-science contingent of the Republican Party again and again and again try to block research, but you're actually helping to fund research. You want to talk about that?
Sure. My amendments, I've passed approximately 70 amendments in the past 3 years alone. Marco Rubio has passed zero. My amendments have moved $71 million from the military budget to the health research budget. That's a substantial amount of money. And I'm particularly pleased that it was taken from that particular source. We've passed all sorts of very important amendments. To give you some examples, Just a week ago, we passed an amendment that increased free tax advice for seniors by 50%. I recently passed an amendment that increased bilingual housing counseling by 50%. I reversed the brutal, brutal Republican cuts on senior housing entirely. I've done the kind of legislating that Marco Rubio can't even dream of. In his 5 years in the Senate, his whole total legislative output consists of resolutions to rename September Spinal Cord Injury Month. The man has done nothing. I've had one progressive accomplishment after another, despite the fact that the Tea Party is basically in charge of the House of Representatives. There are 26 Grayson bills that were passed by the House, passed by the Senate, signed into law by the President. My primary opponent hasn't been able to write a single bill that even passed the House.
Another area that's so important, many of us are aware of the terrible burden that's been put on our armed services. You've worked to improve death benefits, and you've expanded mental health care. And since we know what the suicide rate is of former military, that's invaluable.
Yes, the death benefit for widows and widowers was about to expire, and I got a two-year extension of it. And that was in league with veterans organizations all around the country. And I passed an amendment recently to guarantee mental health screenings to everyone who leaves the service, because when I went to Afghanistan to visit the troops, I could see that a lot of them were under a staggering, enormous amount of stress. I was told that roughly half of them have to take sleeping pills to get to sleep every night. And that's tragic. These are people who need to make a big adjustment when they leave the service, and they need to get every kind of assistance they possibly can so that they can make that adjustment in a productive manner that works for them. So now all of them will be able to get mental health support whenever they leave the service.
Another critical thing that you worked on, you know, many of us are appalled at the kind of war profiteering that we've seen again and again and again. Examples that the investigations have turned up. You've actually worked to punish contractors who cheat the government.
Well, that's right. You know, we've been insistent that every appropriations bill that leaves the House has a rider on it that says that if you cheat the government, you can't get any more federal contracts. What happens right now is that, bizarrely, when you apply for a federal contract, you have to tell the government, the contracting officer, whether you've been charged or convicted of a series of crimes, one of which is defrauding the government, but then the contracting officer can just ignore that and give you the contract anyway. So it's crime without punishment. And what we've done is we've put these Grayson riders, which we call the corporate death penalty, into these bills. And now we have a Republican partner in the Senate who's indicated to us that he'll put those bills in the Senate Appropriations Committee output as well. So with me working in the House, with him working in the Senate, I think we're going to see this become the law, and contractors will finally get the punishment that they deserve for cheating the taxpayers and cheating the troops.
Well, that's exactly right. Cheating the troops and cheating the taxpayers. Another issue that's very important, many of us who work in the cyber industries are aware of the encryption issues that are being glossed over by too much of the business community. And I know you've worked on the smart meter technology to make sure that that information, instead of being broadcasted in the clear, is in fact encrypted. Could you talk about that?
Yes, we've passed two very important amendments for the sake of privacy. One of them has to do with the fact that your smart meter outside your home is connected through cellular service or otherwise through the internet to the electric company, power company, so that they don't have to go to your house and send readers any longer. Most homes are now equipped that way just so that they can save that money. And these smart meters, their data is not encrypted. So whatever is on the smart meters is readable to anybody, literally, who has the right equipment just driving past your house. That could be your name. It could be your social security number. It could be your electrical usage. And as homes become more and more wired internally, and as products become more and more wired, they'll be able to read what's in your medicine chest and what's in your refrigerator. And that's a very dangerous situation to be in. It not only facilitates identity theft, but also even blackmail. And it's a gross invasion of privacy. So I passed an amendment, a Grayson Amendment, to require the power companies to encrypt the data on the smart meters. I also passed another amendment that's important for the same reason. The National Security Agency, the spies, were deliberately undermining encryption standards so that they could spy on people. And they were doing that through NIST, the National Institute on Standards. And what I did was I passed an amendment that prohibited NSA from ordering NIST to do whatever the NSA wanted. Instead, NIST has to exercise its own independent judgment for the sake of encryption and privacy, rather than for the sake of creating backdoors that the NSA can exploit.
Many of us in Florida who are aware of the incredible damage that's been wrecked on this state have been aware of environmental issues for a long time, as have you. And I know I'm really happy to hear, as are many of us, that you're going to be doing a tour of the much damage from the runoff from Lake Okeechobee.
Yes, but again, it's not just a matter of showing up and witnessing the carnage. It's a matter of doing something useful.
Yep.
The Republicans cut the president's budget proposal for the National Estuary Program. That's a program that covers both areas on the Atlantic coast in Florida and areas on the Gulf Coast that are estuaries, like, for instance, Tampa Bay, like the Indian River, and so on. And I was able to, just last week, in an amendment I introduced at midnight, reverse those GOP cuts and get the full funding that the president asked for. That's crucial. My opponent, in contrast, my primary opponent, Patrick Murphy, tried to delay the announcement of a relief program at the SBA so that he could try to take credit for it at a news conference. And that's shockingly irresponsible. Some people call that an impeachable offense if you can impeach a congressman. He's trying to fake the news, whereas we're trying to do real things that often people may not ever find out about. One of the downsides to passing an amendment at midnight is that it's too late for the newspapers to report on it. But the fact is that we were able to do that, reverse the GOP cuts, and fully fund these programs so that the problem that we're facing concerning hypoxia and runoff and so on can see some kind of relief.
Well, we're really pulling for you on that. We know you're going to do your best. If you were to say one of the biggest issues or among the big issues that are facing this country in 2017, what would you name a couple of the top issues in front of us?
Well, I can tell you my priority. My priority is this. Seniors deserve a raise. I'm not saying that everyone agrees with me that this is the number one issue. I'm just saying that I feel like this is where I have to concentrate, because Florida hasn't had a champion for seniors since Claude Pepper died in 1989. And we desperately need that. You know, I'll leave it to others to be, leaders in whatever areas they see fit. But I don't see anybody leading the charge for more Social Security and more Medicare benefits. And that's something that I've been doing my whole adult life. I founded the Alliance for Aging Research with Dan Perry, executive director, 30 years ago. When I was a much younger man. It was based upon my master's thesis at Harvard on gerontology and public policy. And as a result of that organization's work, we increased federal funding for senior health research by over 500%. When we started, there were only a handful of researchers anywhere in the world who were working on improving senior health. Now there are hundreds upon hundreds of them who are leading the research and actually creating cures, and that is showing that our money is being spent wisely and for the benefit of our well-being. I was also a director of Florida Senior Programs. I indicated to you earlier that we reversed these brutal GOP cuts in senior housing, got a 50% increase on free tax advice. But in some respects, the biggest issue facing us now is how are we going to be able to expand Social Security, expand Medicare? Social Security benefits haven't been increased in 40 years. So we've had three entire generations of seniors cycle through the program without a single dollar increase in benefits. In fact, during the time that per capita income in the United States has gone up by 97%, the benefits received by seniors through the Social Security Administration has gone down by 3%. And it's become an enormous problem. Last year alone, seniors were cheated out of $25 billion in benefits. That's $400 for every single Social Security recipient because the cost of living adjustments were miscalculated. So we have a Grayson Senior platform that does three things. First, It expands Medicare by including eyes, ears, and teeth. I have 175 co-sponsors for that bill. Secondly, it fixes the problem with the cost of living adjustments that cheated seniors this year and fixes it going forward as well. Third, I've joined with a Republican to eliminate the double taxation of Social Security benefits. You pay taxes when you pay in, you pay taxes again when it pays out to you. And finally, the Grayson bill to scrap the cap makes Social Security solvent forever and ever. That's the senior platform. That's what I'm regarding as my number one priority in the House, and if the voters are willing, in the Senate next year as well.
Well, sir, thank you so very much. That's a tremendous agenda, and I can't tell you how impressed I am. Thank you so very much for joining us. Any final thought you want to leave with the audience?
Yeah, I'm running a campaign that's unique throughout the entire country. My campaign is the only campaign that's financed mostly by small contributors. It's hard to believe, but I'm only one, and the only candidate in the entire country whose Senate campaign is financed mostly from people who give less than $200. I'm the only member of the House of Representatives whose 2014 campaign was financed that way, and I'm the only member of the House of Representatives whose 2012 campaign was financed that way. We raised $4 million from the grassroots, from people who actually want nothing in return but good government. They want to see a senator who's unbought and unbossed. We've had 150,000 contributions at our website, senatorwithguts.com, the very modestly named senatorwithguts.com. And this is the people's campaign. People have been wanting to see this for a very, very, very long time. A campaign by somebody who actually doesn't owe anybody to anything but the people, and can do the right thing, make sure that we do the greatest good for the greatest number. That is the Grayson campaign at senatorwithguts.com.
Thank you so much, sir, and I look forward to voting for you many times.
Thank you very much. In the Bronx, we used to say vote early and often.
Take care, sir.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks again.